You are Locked On Vikings, your daily Minnesota Vikings podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Boy, we got a lot to catch up on, don't we? What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Locked On Vikings, brought to you by Rock Auto. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. Head on over to rockauto.com and please let them know that Locked On sent you. I'm your host, your pal, and the kid you copied off in math class. My name is Luke Braun. You can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can find the show on Twitter at LockedOnVikings. And the big news, and it's probably going to bring in a couple of new viewers, so welcome if you are new listeners. Welcome if you are new to the show. But it looks like football is actually going to come back. Since we last spoke, the NFL and the NFLPA reached a comprehensive agreement that covered everything from an opt-out clause to the structure of training camp to all the questions that were previously unanswered. A little last minute for my tastes, but there's a lot to go over. Plus, a couple of updates on what we talked about on Thursday. But if you're new, welcome. I am your host, your pal, the kid you copied off in math class. This is a daily Vikings podcast that rain, snow, or shine, off-season or on-season, you will always get shows Monday through Thursday uploaded in the morning, so I hope you stick around. So first, let's talk about a couple of the things we talked about on Thursday. So the Mike Zimmer extension, when last we spoke, the language was like being finalized. That all was officialized very soon after I finished that show. So just quick mention of that. It is a three-year deal that tacks on to the end of 2020. So he's under contract now through 2023. Like I said on Thursday, still doesn't prevent the Vikings from like firing him if there's a disaster, if they go like 2-14 and they want to or whatever. But he's no longer coaching in a contract year, which is important. Also, when we last spoke, only about half of the rookies had signed when I recorded that. About 10 hours after that podcast went up, the rest of the rookies finished up. So everything went according to plan. No weird, funny business. All good to go. The other thing I want to talk to you about before we get into the new training camp plan and kind of how 2020 is going to look different. I also, if I have time, I would like to get to a very cool interview that I have. I kind of teased it last week with Chuck Zotta, who is a kicking writer. He used to write for Inside the Pylon. He hasn't in a while, but he's still kind of widely regarded as a kicking expert. He was a kicker at Dartmouth, and he spent a lot of time writing about kicking mechanics. I learned a ton in that interview. I can't wait to share it with you. I hope I can get it in at the end of this show. If not, I'll probably get to it tomorrow. Kind of depends on how long it takes to talk about all of this new training camp stuff. But before we get into any of that, I want to talk to you about what went down with Dalvin Cook this weekend. It got a little weird. If you're not on Twitter, or if you haven't been like keeping up with like daily stuff, or on like Facebook or Reddit or whatever, you may have missed this. And if so, you are blessed, because this is like an excruciatingly mundane story. But it's kind of weird, and I should probably mention it. Basically, in a press conference on Saturday, with Mike Zimmer talking about his extension and training camp coming up and kind of just like addressing a bunch of things, somebody asked about Dalvin Cook and if he was going to come to camp. His words were, "I was told he will be there." And somebody said, "Who told you that?" And Zimmer said, "He did," referring like saying Dalvin Cook did. That wording is very important. We will get back to that. So it seemed like the holdout was going to be over, and whatever negotiating leverage it provided was enough, or he decided it wasn't worth it. Of course, with the new CBA, holding out is going to look a lot different. If you hold out for an entire season, your contract tolls, which means whatever he would have been paid in 2020, which he wasn't happy with, would be copy-pasted into 2021, and we would do this all over again. So from the NFL's perspective, you can basically hold out all day, and you'll never actually be able to be released from your contract, whereas before, you could hold out to the end of your deal and go test the free agency market, kind of like Le'Veon Bell did. You can't do that anymore. The team would have to like opt to replace you. So it seemed like all of that had set in and training camp was coming up, and he was just going to kind of say, all right, worth a shot. I'm just going to show up. But then his agent, Zach Hill, decided to reach out to, I want to say either Tom Pelissero or Ian Rappaport. I apologize. I forget which, but basically said, hey, we never told Mike Zimmer that. Dalvin Cook hasn't said anything. I have no idea why he said that. So, oh boy, now we got like a whole thing. So then the beat reporters and the journalists start to poke around and do their work. And what came out, I think it was Pelissero again, had basically figured out that Dalvin Cook didn't tell Mike Zimmer anything. He told Kennedy Polamalu, the running backs coach, that he was going to show up to camp. And then Kennedy Polamalu relayed that to Mike Zimmer, who then said it in the press conference. But even after that, like shortly after that came out, then Zach Hill again was like, no, we didn't tell Kennedy Polamalu either. So it's all very confusing. It's all also extraordinarily dumb. We don't need to know right now whether or not he's going to show up to training camp. It does not affect our lives one bit. We can just kind of wait and see if he shows up on Tuesday. Like, it really just seems like somebody texted somebody with, like, weird wording and they didn't understand it. And it's, like, two text messages and this will all be cleared up. And honestly, like, 48 hours after you listen to this podcast, we will know whether or not Dalvin Cook showed up to camp. So I'm kind of happy to just wait till then. So let's move on instead and talk about some of the different things, especially with regard to training camp. Now, we talked a little bit last week about some of the stuff the Vikings are doing and the walkthrough that Eric Sugarman did with Peter King and all the stuff we could learn from that. But suffice it to say that the Vikings have taken quite a few precautions to like limit transmission and spread and essentially to try their best to curb the spread of COVID-19 if and when a Vikings player comes down with it. You can't even get into the building until you have taken a temperature scanner test that won't even work if you aren't wearing a mask. Plus a whole bunch of social distancing measures and sanitation measures and basically minimizing the amount that several people are in the same room together and basically making it impossible inside the facility to like really ever be within 6 feet of people, even going so far as to put alarms on people's watches or on their like contact tracing wristbands. And I'm sure other teams are going through similar precautions. However, somebody's going to come down with it. And most NFL teams understand that like you can only kind of contain, you can't really prevent entirely. So training camp's going to look a whole lot different. And a lot of this also has to do with the revenue hit that the NFL is going to take. I'm probably going to talk about the salary cap ramifications in a future episode. I think that really deserves like more of a deep dive in terms of the Vikings 2021 cap situation and how it will affect them. But suffice it to say right now, the 2021 cap will not be able to go any lower than $175 million, and they'll basically spread out the revenue hit over like that 4 years. But the 2020 cap will not be affected, which means the Vikings can take their current roster and head into camp, with the exception of cutting it down to 80 players, which is something we're going to talk about in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about your car. I think there are too many people in the world that like do not take car maintenance seriously, and they'll just kind of like not really get their oil changed until it's like 2,000 or 3,000 miles too long, or they hear a little noise, they just say, it's fine, it still gets me from point A to B, so I'll just get it. Stop doing that. Take care of your car. Whether that's taking it to a mechanic or even just as simple as learning how to do your own oil changes or replacing the battery every like 3-ish years, you kind of have to do that. A really big one, and I'm stupid enough to be on the wrong side of this one. If you're in quarantine and you're not driving to work anymore, make sure you don't let your car sit in the garage for 2 weeks and let the battery completely die, because I had to buy a new one like an idiot. So to get all the supplies to make sure that you're taking the right care of your car, go to rockauto.com. Enter your make, your model, your year, and you can scroll through all of the different options for whatever you could possibly need, from electric to oil to all sorts of car parts. Their selection is absolutely insane. Head on over to rockauto.com and please, please, please let them know that Locked On sent you there. Okay, so let's start going over some of these changes. The first one I want to talk about is the practice squad and roster size changes, because they kind of go hand in hand. So basically, how it's going to work is this. By August 16th, all of the teams have to have their rosters cut down to 80 players from the 90 maximum they're at right now. The Vikings have 87 players. They'll have to cut 7. I've got a little list. I'll link it in the show notes of who I think that could be, but speculating on it seems kind of dumb, so I guess I'll just kind of leave it in the show notes. You can peruse it at your leisure. That's just my guess, though. So players are still going to report to camp on Tuesday for the Vikings and for most clubs. Like this week, I think most, if not all of the clubs are going to have like all of their players report to training camp. So you theoretically could have a 90-man roster practice until August 16th, and then you have to make 10 cuts. So the deal with that is basically that you have to, if you have more than 80 players, you have to split up your roster into two groups. Group one is rookies, quarterbacks, and injured players that need to come back for rehab. That's who usually would report to camp first. Group two is everyone else. And those two groups cannot interact with each other. They can't be on the field at the same time, and they cannot practice together. You're essentially trying to help like compartmentalize the roster in case of spread and just kind of like minimize interaction. But that can be really difficult, right? Like if you have a quarterback who reported in group one and a non-rookie healthy center who reported in group two, which would be the Vikings, your quarterback can't practice with your center during training camp. That seems disastrous. Now, by August 16th, they'll get it, and they'll have a couple weeks to practice together before the actual game, or I think 3 weeks, to practice together before the actual game starts, so it should be all right, but it is probably a disadvantage, so you probably want to get your rosters down to 80. The other thing is, I mean, like, the bottom seven people on the roster are probably pretty far outside of the realm of, like, realistically making the team and, like, being something. However, for the Vikings, they've already kind of decided that they're going to split their team into, like, rotating groups. I think they were going to maybe split it differently, and I don't know if their split, like, satisfies the NFL's requirements, or if they would have to, like, change the way they think about that split, but it could be worth it to keep those seven players around just to kind of get a better sense for who, like, shouldn't actually even make it to padded practices. If you were already planning to split up your roster that way anyways, then, you know, there's really no harm in it. But a lot of teams have actually already made those cuts. The Patriots, the Seahawks, a whole bunch of other ones I'm forgetting. So by the time you're listening to this, the Vikings could have already made those cuts. Of course, we'll talk about them when they happen. But if they don't make the cuts until actually August 16th, it's probably because they were already splitting up their team in a satisfactory way as part of, like, the social distancing measures that they've put in, and then it doesn't really affect it. The other thing that goes kind of hand in hand with that, though, is that the practice squad has been expanded. Now, I think I mentioned this on Thursday, but let's talk about it. So usually your practice squad can be 10 players. Now it's expanded to 16, and you can protect four of them. And I think the big impact of this is with kind of, like, mid-round draft picks that would have otherwise not made the team had you not, like, just spent a fourth rounder and you kind of want to keep them around and stash them and make sure that, like, they don't get poached or whatever. This was like Drew Samia last year, right? Like, he never cracked the second team. He never made it to, like, second team reps. He was very clearly like a developmental project type guy, and it seemed to pay off. Week 17, he played pretty well. In that scenario, you kind of have to stash him on the 53. If you try to get him through waivers, somebody's going to poach him, and you don't really, like, feel like you can confidently get him through waivers. But with this, you actually could have cut him, put him on the practice squad, and, you know, maybe elevate him for week 17, put him back on the practice squad. You could have done all of that without him ever being exposed to waivers and without you ever having a chance of losing him to another team. You assign him to a deal to play for and try to make the team in 2020, and there you go. There you have it. Everything would have been exactly the same. So this could be really helpful for that situation, and I imagine you're going to see a lot more, like, fourth, fifth-ish rounders get cut this year than you would other years. But I think that's okay, because it makes it more of a merit-based decision, right? If an undrafted free agent outplays a fourth rounder, usually, or say, like, an undrafted free agent outplays a fourth rounder, but just, like, barely, you're probably going to keep the fourth rounder based on, like, potential or just, like, draft pedigree or whatever. Now, you don't really necessarily need to worry about that. You can just kind of keep the best player. And if you do end up having, like, a fourth rounder on the outside looking in, say, you know, Troy Dye doesn't really, like, live up to what we think he is, or DJ Wanham doesn't live up to what we think he is, you can put him on the practice squad protected, stash him there all year, and, you know, try again during a normal offseason. I think that's a really nice, luxurious option for teams to have. Not great for those players, obviously. It kind of robs them of choice, and of course being on the practice squad doesn't pay nearly as much as being on the roster, but them's the breaks when you're trying to make the team. Another big one was the opt-out clause. So this was a big thing to get an opt-out option given to all of the players, and essentially it goes like this. So you can opt out of the 2020 season without forfeiting your place in the NFL. You don't have to retire or do anything weird. Essentially, you can choose to toll your contract all the way from whatever you were going to get paid in 2020 to whatever you're going to get paid in 2021 and just copy-paste that money over. It would kind of be like you held out all year, but you also get a stipend, and the size of that stipend depends on your risk level. So there's two groups, high risk and low risk. And the only difference is high risk groups are people who have been diagnosed with a thing on, I think a little too short of a list, but a list of, like, things that would make you at, like, worse risk of getting seriously harmed by COVID-19, things like being immunocompromised, having had cancer, having, like, sickle cell disease, and other similar things, HIV, stuff like that. Asthma is one. So being in the high-risk group gives you a bigger stipend, a $350,000 stipend. Everybody else gets a $150,000 stipend, but everybody still gets the contract toll thing. And so it'll be interesting to see how many players opt out. The people, the beat reporters that have poked around say it's going to be a fair amount of people. We've already had one, a guard for the Chiefs, who has been working as an orderly this summer and kind of seen the front lines, has opted out, which is, like, very ominous. But we'll see who else follows in his footsteps. Right now, there is a reserve COVID-19 list, and a few players have already been put on it that have tested positive. No Vikings, a couple of Browns, I think somebody on the Seahawks, a few other players. the Vikings have done and do have results from their first round of COVID-19 tests. However, we just don't know what those results are. And we probably won't until people go on this COVID-19 reserve list. And it is basically like an injured reserve list and stuff. And I believe you still get paid unless you have engaged in high risk behavior. And there's a whole list of what high risk behavior is, but it's stuff like going to nightclubs, going to bars, going to sporting events that aren't football games that you're like playing in. But if you do any of that stuff, you actually like don't get paid. It's treated then like a non-football injury, or I think they're talking right now about that could be treated like a non-football injury. Of course, they'll probably go, case by case with that kind of thing. But with a non-football injury, you do not get paid your game checks. If you break your leg in a football game, you still get paid while you rehab because you suffered that injury on the field. If you're playing a pickup basketball game and you sprain your ankle and you miss games, you don't get paid. The NFL says we're not responsible for comping you for that because we didn't cause your injury. And if you engage in high-risk behavior and you come down with COVID-19, they are basically saying we kind of reserve the right to make that same declaration as if you broke your ankle playing a pickup basketball game. So the moral of the story is maybe stay out of the nightclub if you're trying to play in the NFL. And you know what? Stay out of the nightclub in general, you crazy kids who are listening. That's just like one of the dumbest things you can do right now. I will link some of the, if you want to read through like the whole agreement, some people have tweeted out screenshots of it. So I'll link that stuff in the show notes if you want to peruse. But for now, I am going to move on to a very cool guest spot. So I talked to Chuck Zada. He'll tell you about his experiences in the interview, but really quick, he was a kicker at Dartmouth, one of the most athletic kickers in Ivy League history. And he was there for 3 years. And then he eventually started writing about kicking and breaking down kicking mechanics. And he's kind of one of the only people out there that talks about kicking in a way that is beyond the make-miss binary. Usually we just talk about field goal percentage or field goal percentage by like distance, but it never really goes beyond like a heuristic of did you or did you not make the kick. And Chuck Zada does go beyond that, and I find it fascinating. I've been a fan of his work for years, so I was super geeked out to be able to chat with him about kicking. Basically, we got into it like a few weeks ago. I said something about like kickers don't matter, which is a take that I've had on this show quite a bit about like kickers not really being, I told it to him in the interview, so I'll explain it then. But I basically said, listen, I don't think it matters who your kicker is, and you study this, so you probably have different information on that, you know, prove me wrong or maybe prove me right or whatever. I didn't really know what he was going to say. So I hope you learn as much from this interview as I did. I found it awesomely informative, and I've listened back to it a couple times just for fun. So that is coming right up. All right, everybody. I am here with Chuck Zada of Inside the Pylon, and I guess I don't know what you're up to exactly these days, so why don't you let me know that?
Yeah, appreciate you having me on here, Luke, and pretty much used to write and manage Inside the Pylon until about the end of 2017, when unfortunately I had some other projects that got in the way, so I've kind of moved on from there at this point. But pretty much I was a kicker in college at Dartmouth College. I kicked for 3 years thereafter, kind of washing out of the soccer team there as a freshman. And so, you know, after school was just kind of trying to find some other things to do in areas that interested me, and fortunately got hooked up with an awful lot of other talented people at Inside the Pylon, and they decided that they wanted someone to talk about special teams. So I did that for about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, really my focus and my kind of two areas of study there were, you know, basic special teams tactics and, you know, figuring out how teams would attack on kickoff returns, punt returns and things like that. But then also analyzing kicker mechanics right down, unfortunately, to the Minnesota Vikings. I'm not going to mention any specifics because you don't need that from me.
I'm very familiar with the Blair Walsh piece. I've cited it a couple times.
You said it, not I, so we'll just leave it at that. But, again, just trying to break down what's actually going on with kickers because, you know, it's an area that has a lot of focus in today's game, but not a whole lot of people understand what goes into it. And so I just kind of viewed my role as educational and trying to give people some insight into my little world of football.
That's awesome. And if the listeners are interested, I'll link the Blair Walsh piece in the show notes. I know it brought me a sense of peace knowing kind of what happened and that it wasn't some mysterious fluke, but that there was actually like some more mechanical stuff going on. So I'll link that for the listeners. But what I really want to talk to you about today is just the idea of like how important kickers are. And usually when we say important, it's how important it is like relative to salary cap and resource spending.
And I, for a while, I've had the take that it doesn't really matter enough who your kicker is to like justify spending resources on it or like extending a kicker to a big deal or drafting a kicker, for example. I went completely off the rails when the Vikings drafted Daniel Carlson because essentially the take that I have is A, we're not very good at evaluating kickers because we don't get a big enough sample to just look at, you know, if you've kicked 80 times in college, like that's a golf game, right? Like that's not a huge sample of actual kicks to be able to work off of to actually evaluate someone. And so we have like a lot of trouble actually figuring out who is or isn't good. But even if we were perfect at figuring out who is and isn't good, the difference, you know, barring some sort of Roberto Aguayo catastrophe where they miss, you know, 40% of their kicks or something, by and large, the difference between some having a Justin Tucker or like a prime Greg Zuerlein and having like a mediocre to bad kicker is going to be like 4 or 5 kicks that are going to be missed over the course of the season. So you're talking about like a missed field goal every 2 or 3 games. And the odds that that missed field goal actually ends up in a game where it would have been the difference also compounds onto that. And the idea of it like actually adding a win seems to be like you can find more value elsewhere. It's not a zero value, but it's value you can find elsewhere. So there's either I'm right or I'm not very good at evaluating kickers. And it's not too unlikely for it to be the second one. So I guess what I want to hear from you is what can I learn to like be better at evaluating kickers? What mechanical stuff can I like learn to evolve beyond binary made or missed the field goal, like field goal percentage and stuff, even if you like adjust by distance or whatever. I feel like there's a lot more evolution that I can have there. So I guess go ahead and dunk on me.
Well, no dunking here. I actually tend to agree with a decent chunk of what you just said. And I like to break it down into two different pieces. Specifically, I think there's a real difference between evaluating and paying for kicker talent from college and paying for talent that is already established at the pro level. So let's start by talking about college kickers. As you mentioned, the sample sizes are relatively small. So I think that it's often very challenging to get a good read on what's going on with a college kicker to begin with. So I agree on that front. But the other piece that we need to look at with regards to college kickers is that fundamentally, when we talk about not just your evaluations of special teamers and specialists here, but when we talk about NFL evaluations of specialists, is there any conclusive evidence that NFL teams really know what they're doing when it comes to drafting kickers or even figuring out who should be an undrafted free agent? I don't really think that there is. It's pretty much, hey, did that guy make a bunch of kicks? Okay, great. You know, most teams don't have a dedicated coach working on kicking mechanics and things like that. It's not somewhere that they spend a lot of time or resources. And so I think
Vikings and Nate Kading is a fairly unique thing.
Yeah, I think that when you look at it, it just is not a place of focus. So my view has been, and I wrote a piece back in, I think it was 2015, on this topic of, look, should my team draft a kicker? And I pretty much said, look, under no circumstances at all should a team draft a kicker in rounds 1 to 3. It just doesn't make sense when you look at the value. Even if you're talking about the difference from, you know, the best kicker in the league to the worst kicker in the league, you're pretty much talking about 3 touchdowns a year. It's about like 20 to 22 points in a normal year is that difference. So yeah, if you know that you're drafting the best kicker in the league right as a rookie, okay, you could probably do that, but there's no evidence that teams can do that. And so with that in mind, I said, look, don't draft any kickers in the first 3 rounds because it doesn't make sense to spend those draft resources there just because you can find a far more impactful player who can add more value to your team at a bigger discount from what their prospective positional salary would be. I think that's a key focus as well is, look, if you're getting a really productive D end or a really productive cornerback in rounds 1, 2, or 3, how much are you saving over a veteran in those areas? It's huge because those positions get paid a boatload of money. Even the best kickers in the league, they get $5 million a year. So you're saving, you know, $4 to $5 million, you know, $4.5 million when it's all said and done on a, you know, high draft pick. Look, it's just not worth it from a value perspective. The place where I do think it can make some sense, though, is if you have a kicker with an established track record in the NFL. When we talk about value and the difference, again, between kind of that best and worst kicker in the league, again, we're talking, you know, somewhere in that range of 20 points over the course of a season. If you do the math out and try to figure out, okay, what's it actually costing me to get that production with pretty much every single kicker out there, if you look aside from Justin Tucker, there's no kicker out there getting more than about $4.7, $4.8 million per year right now. So it's relatively cheap money. You know, you're talking 2 to 2.5% of the cap to get someone in the upper echelon of your position. I do think that that's an area where if you have established talent, it makes sense to do so, but there's a couple caveats here. Number one, kickers can lose it in an instant. We've seen cases of this where guys just fall apart, you know, after really promising either starts in the league or, you know, long track records. Chandler Catanzaro with Arizona was one of these examples from a few years back where I thought he was going to be the next big thing. And then he just hit, you know, a case of the yips for about 6 weeks. And it was pretty much all done after that. So my caveat is, look, I would rather pay a kicker a high salary but keep a short length of contract than be stuck with, you know, a kicker on an average salary for a long time. So I'm a big proponent, short contracts, bunch of guaranteed money to make them, you know, stick around there. So, you know, a 2-year, $8 million deal with $7 million of it guaranteed sounds great to me because, look, if worse comes to worse, I can cut them without any major cap problems. I don't like the deals where they're, you know, 5 years, $20 million, $13 million guaranteed, because if he goes bad in year one, I'm on the hook for like $12 million a cap hit just to get rid of a kicker that I don't want anymore.
Yeah, that sounds about close to what the Vikings have done with Dan Bailey. They're kind of going year by year just because he's old too. So I guess we have a couple minutes here and we might go a little long. That's okay. If I wanted to get better at figuring out who the best kicker in the league is, either for scouting for free agency or just for me, like making content about it, where can I look beyond just did they make or miss the kick? Like if I were to evaluate kicking tape, what's the kind of stuff that I should learn to look for?
So the big thing, and it's no different from any other type of process, in that I value simplicity over just about anything else. You want as few moving parts as possible because that means there are fewer places where things can actually go wrong. So there are two general styles of kicking that you see. You see these more upright styles. Dan Bailey's one of them, where if you look at how he kicks, there's not a ton of lean in his motion. You know, his legs out to the side a little bit, but by and large, it's kind of a very upright motion. You know, you take a look at some other guys who kind of work in this fashion. Steven Gostkowski on the Patriots is another one. It's, you know, he's a bigger guy. It's just a lot of motion going right through the ball, very direct, very short, compact stroke. On the other hand, you have guys who I call more of kind of a sidewinding style. And you
know, remember that was Blair Walsh, right?
But Blair Walsh is one of them. You know, these are guys like Cairo Santos on the Chiefs from a couple of years back. You know, those types of guys where it's much more of a full body effort and you almost see them kind of planing out to the side, almost closer to horizontal, where, you know, for a right footed kicker, their head's tilting way out to the left, their body's leaning way left, and the leg is stretched way out to the right to get all that torque. And for me, that's a much tougher motion to repeat because it's just a full max effort. There's a lot more energy and a lot more moving parts and things that can go wrong. You know, it's like comparing, you know, a flame throwing reliever who burns his arm out after throwing, you know, 50 innings in a year just because his mechanics are bad, to a starting pitcher who's just got repeatable, easy flowing mechanics that they can repeat over and over. So, you know, simple is good. When we talk about simple, it's about, look, how big is your backswing? Is it short and compact there? Does it go right through to the ball? Does it loop around instead and kind of come outside in and create kind of this looping path where things can get off track there? You know, what's the follow through look like? Is it something where it's always pointing forward to the target? One of the biggest things that I look for on any kick that I look at is where does the kicker actually follow through to? When his weight comes through the ball afterwards, is it going through to the uprights or is it drifting outside one of the uprights? Usually if it's drifting outside, things tend to go wrong there. So I think one of the biggest places that you can look just at the outset is, look, what's the follow-through look like? And generally, 9 times out of 10, that follow-through will tell you what happened on the kick, even without seeing it.
That's awesome. Maybe I'll have to do something applying all that and kind of visualizing alongside it. That'd be really cool. But that's all the time. I'll stop taking up your time too. So thank you so much, Chuck. Where can I find your work, or what do you want to plug here at the end?
Well, all my old work is still up on Inside the Pylon. I'm unfortunately not doing anything new over there right now. But yeah, you can check that out. That's pretty much where all my stuff is still held at this point. And again, Luke, I really appreciate you bringing me on here.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. Maybe we'll have to talk again about the other side of your expertise in terms of like special teams tactics, especially in a preseasonless 2020 season where they won't get to coach as much of that stuff up.
Absolutely. And hopefully we're talking about only good special teams news from the Vikings in the future. No bad stuff. All right.
We can only hope. Thank you so much, Chuck.
All right. Thanks again.
That was Chuck Zotta at Inside the Pylon. Extraordinaire. So go follow him. His information is in the show notes, and some of the stuff that he talked about in that interview is in the show notes, as well as all the stuff we talked about earlier in this show. Don't forget, you can always find me on Twitter and yell at me about whatever I got wrong at Luke Braun NFL or at Locked On Vikings to tweet at the show. I will see you all tomorrow. I'm going to talk about roster predictions soon enough here. I also have another very cool interview with Andrew Erickson of PFF. He's a fantasy expert, so if you're getting your fantasy drafts underway now that there's going to be a season, you're not going to want to miss that. So be sure to come back when that drops. I will see you all tomorrow, and as always, Skull.